Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This is a new type of episode. We're calling it Stock Takes, where Simon and I give our opinions on the latest food news, talk about what we're seeing on Instagram and finish off with a couple of hot tips.
All right, Mr. Evans, it's good to be with you once again. How you going, mate?
Yeah, pretty good, mate. How have you been? How's the house down the coast?
Yeah, it's very, very nice down here. Even though we're under lockdown now, we've got nothing to complain about.
Down here. This is like your first real lockdown as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been due some lockdown. You've been due a little bit of lockdown, just a little bit.
Due a little bit of lockdown, but the thing about lockdown down here, like down here I just cook at home anyway, you know? Like there aren't that many great restaurants to go out to. I would have liked to have gone to The Whale, the Merivale thing that they opened in Naruma. I would have liked to, you know, just supported a few more businesses. Like if you lived in a place like Milton or Jervis Bay or somewhere a bit further north, Mollymook and Ulladulla and those places, there's a bit more going on in terms of like being able to go out and get some, like, you know, have nice meals numerous times a week or however you want to dine. But where I am, which is south of Batemans Bay, but not quite as far as like Naruma and Bermagui, it's pretty few and far between.
So even not going anywhere.
Even now in lockdown, like if I want to get takeaway, I'm pretty limited in my area to like there's pizza place, there's a burger place, and there's a Thai place, and that's kind of it. You know, I don't actually have I don't have Basque cheesecakes and you know, four course like menus
and restaurants made serving as bottle shops and delivery.
Yeah. We'll get on to Basque cheesecakes later. But
can't wait.
Inform the audience. Simon and I were sort of thinking about a bit of a way that we're going to produce more content because we'd like to produce more, and you know, we've only got a limited amount of time and resources, so we want to do something that's easy for us, and continue this podcast on a weekly basis through these lockdowns while we're not living in the same city. So in the same way that restaurants have had to pivot their business model to adapt to the pressures of pandemic life, lockdown, and everything that comes with it, so is the Food Fight podcast, ladies and gentlemen. So we now bring you our new style of episode, which is going to be from here on. Here forth will be called Stock Takes, and it will be an episode in which Simon and I give our take on some food news that's happening around the world. So we'll be tinkering with the format a little bit, but essentially each of us is going to bring in a food news story to chat about, and we'll have a conversation about them. And then we'll try to keep it brief. And then after that, we're going to talk about one thing that we were seeing on Instagram that's sort of tickling us in one way or another.
We're basically bringing the contents of our Facebook Messenger group to a podcast.
Exactly.
Because this would be the stuff we link each other to, the little tidbits we send each other and discuss throughout the week in podcast form.
Yeah, in audio form. Yeah. And the last bit, and then at the end, we're going to do one recommendation each, one hot tip each, whether that's cooking or dining or figuring out like navigating lockdowns or whatever it might be. So it's just some more sort of personable stuff from Simon and I. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, Simon, realistically, do people want to hear from us, or do they want to hear from celebrity chef guests on this podcast? And I'll tell you what.
I mean, I've heard some people say that they just get in the way of our banter. Well, so, I mean...
There's a lot of podcasts out there that interview chefs, and there's not that many podcasts out there that's literally just two dickheads giving their opinion of things. So, you know, I call it a POD, a point of difference, a pod,
yeah.
if you will. But if maybe will. Maybe our pod for this Stock Takes episode will be the fact that we're not celebrity chefs and we're just asking people what it was like to have a pan thrown at us by Mark Best.
Yeah, so we're gonna bring you a mix of news, mix of things going on in the hospitality world, and just some things we've noticed on social media and in the hospitality internet sphere.
And not to be confused with Small Bites. Small Bites is going to continue as well, where Simon and I harp on about one particular subject for the best part of half an hour to an hour. But we'll try to keep these ones at around half an hour. We want to just talk about what's going on in the news. You might even be getting some two episodes a week with these ones coming through. Imagine that, right?
Yeah.
Hope you like them. So, Simon, let's kick it off. You've got your first story to have a quick chin wag about this week. What is
it? So, big news in hospitality world was last weekend's article from Sydney Morning Herald about Jockson Frillo, ex-Orana chef, current master chef judge, and alluded to his new book called Last Shot, which pertains to the last shot of heroin he did in a Heathrow toilet before returning to Australia in the early 2000s. So a very interesting article, got some traction around the place. Tim Elliott, the author of the article, seemed to follow Jock around for a little while. And was doing an interview, a piece about this book. But after fact-checking or, you know, possibly even getting some of the people in his book, getting in contact with them for comment, found that there may have been some differing opinions of certain events in the book. So the major one, Marco Pierre White, basically disavowing a lot of the stuff that Jock has said prior and in the book, and basically said that you know, Jock is a great guy, but everything he's ever written about me has been false. So a bit of a bombshell on that. Obviously would be quite embarrassing if you've been...
So what did he actually say about his relationship with Marco in Last Shot, the article?
So I mean, it's in the book, but it's things that it's kind of part of Jock's story that every chef kind of needs to have nowadays. So basically, he went to work for Marco at the Hyde Park Hotel in the late 90s, early 2000s. So three Michelin-star hotel in London is where Marco won his three stars. Went to work there, got a job, was homeless at the time, had a heroin addiction, and said that Marco knew, helped him out with some money, let him sleep in the hotel's changing rooms for a while, helped him get a house. Took him fishing. He's referred to him as a bit of a father figure over the years as well. And Marco's come out and said, no, that was true. Same with some of his previous head chefs in Sydney. Said that he should possibly take what he says with a bit of a grain of salt at times. So quite a lot of people who are close to him and work to him disavowing quite a lot of what he said in his book and previous articles. So
before we get into sort of speculating about what may or may not be true, the publisher of Last Shot about a week ago released a statement, which the Sydney Morning Herald reported on. And in that statement, the publisher. In that statement, they basically... defending what was said in Last Shot. And at the same time, in this same article, it talks about how the publisher's statement has come at the same time as an announcement that Jock is being sued by a former landlord for about $200,000 worth of unpaid rent from his wine bar, Malozzi, in Adelaide. That this was reported by the Adelaide Advertiser. So,
First of all,
there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, Jock has come out and obviously spoken out against the article. He said, "This is the story of my life. I've lived every minute of it, the highs and lows, and I stand by it. There's no question that some of my book makes me look pretty unsavory at the best of times. I carry the shame from those years, not pride, and it was a big obstacle for me to overcome when writing this book." So he's come out, obviously denied that it is untrue. There's also some claims from the publisher that part of this story was actually published in the 25th anniversary of Marco's seminal cookbook, White Heat, which I think was actually a quote from a third party quoting Jock's story. So a bit of confusion there as well.
Can you unpack what you meant by that? Because I think you went too quick over it.
From the gist of it, I do have a copy of White Heat, but not the 25th anniversary. So from what I've read, in the 25th anniversary edition, various people were asked to add stories about Marco and him over the years. A journalist included Jock's story about Marco helping him in White Heat. So it seems that Simon Schuster is saying that obviously Marco has been mistaken because some of the stories have appeared in his book, even though they weren't written by Marco, as it were. A little bit confusing. But so as these things are, a lot of he said, she said, back and forth. But the article, I'd advise people to go out and read it. It was entitled, the headline was, "He's Very Nice. The Only Problem Is Chef Marco Pierre White on Jocks on Frillo," by Tim Elliott. Worth a read to see some of the things that were included in the book and some of the people he spoke to. But quite embarrassing for a chef.
Yeah, well, it must be a tough one. Now, I mean, I think, without risking, saying anything disparaging about anyone, I think that we're able to sort of speculate somewhat. And it's interesting because, I mean, Jock has said this stuff about Marco in his book and about his relationship with Marco. And then Marco comes out and says, almost everything he has written about me is untrue. Yeah. Now, the funny thing and the interesting thing to me is that that means that one of them is lying. So either John Frillo is lying about his relationship with Marco Pierre White, or Marco Pierre White has such a fucking vendetta for some reason against Jocks on Frillo that when he releases his book, he says that everything that he said about him in the book is bullshit. Now, and I just think that, like, whatever the truth is, I think that this is such a fucking, on either side of the coin, it's just the quintessential egotistical chef.
Yeah.
Like, because one of them's lying and one of them is embodying the egotistical chef just absolutely perfectly.
So Marco has history of little things like this, like with some of his previous chefs. Like the whole reason like Gordon Ramsay and Mark P. White sort of fell out was like an argument over who stole a reservation book from the restaurant Gordon used to work at. And I think from memory, Gordon blamed Marco for it. And then Marco blamed Gordon for some other stuff. And then there's been like, and if you read their two biographies, they have like differing accounts to the same stories as well. So like, it doesn't seem like it's not below Marco Pierre White just to come out and be like, no, he didn't. Like, that doesn't seem like that's exactly out of the realms either. Like, my old boss, Mark Manson, who is a food writer, has interviewed Marco and they sat down, had dinner, and they've been to some events together, like quite small events together before. And early on,
get him on the podcast.
What? Get Marco on.
Yeah,
you got. He'll claim he's never heard of me. Bastard. And yeah, Mark basically said he's a bit crazy. Like he's actually just a bit of an odd dude. So when yes, definitely battle of the chef egos. It's the article is fascinating.
I think that the interesting, like, I mean, from what I know about PR and about trying to sell a book, is that you want it to be as salacious as possible.
Yeah,
so the more heroin, the better. The more alcoholism, the more homelessness, like all these sorts of things, sell books.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that if Jock had someone helping him write it or editing it and things like that, it's definitely not past a publisher to say, how can we put these stories to the max effect, or how can we sort of add a little bit of salt and pepper to these stories to make them sell books. So, yeah. That's relatively feasible in the same way that, Marco is a bit of an odd dude himself, is quite a feasible explanation. And at the same time, like you look at the press images of Jock and in this article and stuff, and I don't know, like there's these pictures of him in a kilt pissing on a wall and smoking a joint, and like he's definitely taken on the role of this sort of like, you know, pretty got a lot of demons to deal with, the kind of chef guy that's had a rough upbringing and now dealing with.
There's some pretty crazy things the book has seen. There's getting used to cocaine at 13 years old. Seeing one of his school friends be murdered at like 12 years old back in Scotland, which is all pretty wild. One of the biggest parts of the article, which has kind of got a lot of traction on Twitter, is a part where on returning from a Indigenous community that he wasn't allowed into, he got pulled over by the police and asked to leave. She couldn't be there without some sort of permit. And he pulled over his car and punched the red dirt and let out a scream. So, which sounds very much like something you might see in a movie. So there's some bits which are, seem a little bit exaggerated. It seems like a pretty crazy story, but it's an interesting one, especially because it seems that there is quite a lot of skeletons in Jock's past, with recently him being sued by the owners of some of his previous restaurants. He it's in the book as well, but it's been reported by the advisor in the advertising in Adelaide that he actually went bankrupt after a prank gone wrong, where he set fire to an apprentice with basically lighter fluid. The apprentice got some pretty nasty burns, and he got sued for $75,000 in early 2000s. So some sort of unsavory stuff in the background as well, which might lead to a bit of resentment along the way.
Yeah, I don't know, like maybe this is a topic and maybe it's not the place to talk about this sort of thing in these Stock Takes episodes of this podcast, but I think that this recent article in the Sydney Morning Herald about this new statement from the publisher and stuff, talking about how his previous landlord at one of his wine bars in Adelaide, is suing him for $224,000. They've also chose to mention that Rana shut in March last year with combined debts of about $3.2 million, including $340,000 in outstanding rent, $234,000 owed to the ATO, and $88,000 in unredeemed gift vouchers. Now, perhaps we should do a small bites on this. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll shelve it for a small bites. And if you want to hear us sort of dig into this and talk about it, but chefs and especially chefs like Jocks on Filler are celebrities. And if celebrities owe people shitloads of money because of decisions that they've made and closures and those sorts of things, and they're being sued for hundreds of thousands of dollars, I know for a fact that, like, I know chefs out there who have walked out of their premises and owing money to their staff, owing money to their suppliers, and all these sorts of things. Do you think that the media, the food media or the media in general, should hold chefs to a higher standard than the same standard that other celebrities would be held to in these sorts of situations? Because, you know, we've talked about the wage theft issue, and we've talked about, you know, we talked about all sorts of different, you know, things that chefs do and, you know, a lot of the time get away with. And to me, it seems that much of the time, it sort of depends on who you are and who you're friends with as to how the media chooses to cover your misgivings, if you will.
Yeah. I think, an interesting conversation is what role do the media play in background checking people they decide to hold up as celebrities? And I think that's a question that's been happening in the US a lot with a lot of scandals recently. So I think this is more than a Small Bites podcast. I think this is a full-blown podcast with someone who might know what they're talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll park that there and we'll come back to it. But it's definitely something interesting to think on. And we will see, maybe in a future Stock Takes episode, we will report back on whether or not Jocks on Filler owes someone $224,000.
Yeah, or if the Sydney Morning Herald owe Jocks some money for something instead. So we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. Okay. Next thing, the one that I brought in today, and it's a funny one for us to discuss, but the news of the day, the news of the week is that Golden Century Seafood in Sydney has closed, which is a Cantonese restaurant that seems to be the favorite restaurant of every single Sydney chef bar nut. And it's a funny one for us to discuss, because I've not eaten at Golden Century. I mean, like, just because I'm not from Sydney and I don't work at restaurants in Sydney, and I don't, go out for dinner at 2 o'clock in the morning.
You're not hospo frontline either. So
yeah,
you wouldn't be allowed in.
Wouldn't be allowed in, and
nah,
I don't know,
nah,
like,
nah.
Yeah, so
no riffraff.
Is that I'm sort of in the middle of Instagram and, you know, follow all these Sydney, you know, food writers and chefs and these people around the world. Like, if you're not on it, you wouldn't have probably seen or heard this information. But it is literally, you know, over the last couple of days, the fact that Golden Century has closed is bigger news than anything to do with COVID-19.
Yes. I mean, maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe people want someone else to talk about. I think first of all, like, Golden, maybe we'll give it a little bit of context. Golden Century is a pretty iconic place. It's kind of decked out like your average Cantonese restaurant, but they have live fish tanks all through the restaurant. So you can pick out your lobster and they'll take it and go cook it for you. It's open till 3 a.m. And it's become very much a hospo chef hangout after service. I've been there a couple of times, obviously not after service, but I've heard legendary stories about, you know, having Tetsuya and his crew on one table and Peter Gilmore on his other table and Martin Benn on his other, like, you know, and all these hard hitters in hospitality.
Yeah, so that's all outlined in this recent article by Miffy Rigby from today, actually, in Good Food. So yeah, very, very iconic sort of institution. People go there for the XO pippies and the pork congee and
there's also mud
crabs and snow crabs and stuff.
They also had, I mean, this is the kind of the mashup of clientele you had. You could get a bowl of fried rice, you could get pippies, you get whole lobster, but they also had an amazing wine list with vintages of Penfolds Grange going back to like the 50s, which are, you know, completely, you know, unattainable unicorn wines, I think. And the 56 or something, which would be like the third vintage of Grange ever, was on the menu for like $60,000 or something. So They've got some like absolute baller, hard-hitting, iconic Australian wines. So you get a weird mix of hospitality staff, tourists, businessmen dropping thousands of dollars.
Right. Wow. I didn't realize that the wine list, I'd heard the wine list was pretty epic, but I didn't realize that it was that
There's
deep.
There's some pretty epic Burgundy and Bordeaux and some classic Aussie wines on there.
So it's gone into voluntary administration. And this is to do with the fact that their 20-year lease is expiring at the end of August and will not be renewed. Now, a spokesperson from Golden Century said, we've been trying to come to terms with the landlord, but you have to ask, is this the time to commit to another long-term agreement? And so one of the interesting things about this situation is that I've seen a lot of people talking about it on Instagram, and there's been an absolute, like, I literally have never seen an outpouring of grief, if you will, from a hospitality community about the closure of one venue.
It's almost like a celebrity has died, because people are posting like series of pictures of like them sitting at tables and with dishes and with other chefs. So it has been quite hyperbolic.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I think that like one of the things that I sort of am a little bit weird about is that I've seen a lot of these people, and some of them are quite, you know, high profile chefs with a big Instagram following and things like that, saying that it is a victim of COVID. And there doesn't seem to be any information out there that that's actually the case. It doesn't seem to be any information that COVID, you know, has made this business insolvent and means that it has had to close, and it's just come at an opportune time that their 20-year lease is ending at the end of August. There's no information in Miffy Rigby's article about the fact that it's, you know, closing because of COVID. It just says that it's gone into voluntary administration. I've seen and heard like a few whispers and rumors that an administrative process can mean that a place will stay open. And there's also speculation that Golden Century might live on, but just in another location, because this is really just the end of the lease at that Sussex Street location in the middle of Sydney. So there's a few unknowns and things like that. But I think that the most interesting thing about this news is the outpouring from people and the way that it's been done. And like, it's interesting because I just don't think that Golden Century means as much. Like, obviously Golden Century doesn't mean as much to me or you as, you know, Sydney Hospo crew who were there, you know, once a week after service and things like that. It's got a special place in their heart. But let me ask you a controversial question, Simon.
Shoot.
Do you think that people like the fact that they've got this relationship with Golden Century and enjoy posting about it on social media? That's more than I feel for the owners of Golden Century and that they're closing, but more like it's kind of cool that I have this relationship with Golden Century.
I think people, especially hospitality,
it's so cynical.
I think it's a point you made about it almost feels like hospitality people have sort of taken ownership of it, of something that isn't necessarily, or definitely not just there. So I think people.
Well, that's the other problem that I have had with it. And sorry to interrupt you. And like one of the issues for me is that like in this article by Miffy Rigby, she's got quotes from Neil Perry, Dan Hong, and you can kind of guess the rest. She's got Neil Perry, Dan Hong, Mitch Orr. You know, there's no quotes in there from the owners, but I'm 100% sure that Miffy would have approached the owners. There is a statement from a spokesperson from the restaurant, but there are no quotes directly from the owners in the article, Eric and Linda Wong. But yeah, there are quotes in there from Dan Hong, Neil Perry, and Mitch Orr, and David Chang. actually. I don't know, like the thing that doesn't sit well with me with these sorts of things, and some people in their sort of, you know, little obituary Instagram posts about Golden Century have said some really meaningful and really wonderful things. And I think that that's great. And I can understand that when people lose something that is really important to them, that they've shared like some amazing memories at and things like that. It's, you know, it's a sad time and stuff like that. But I think that Golden Century is a Cantonese restaurant. And where it sits and its place in Sydney is reflective of the Chinese community in Sydney as much as it is reflective of the hospitality community in Sydney. So to write an article that's about Golden Century closing that only speaks to celebrity chefs about how it's affected people in Sydney's hospitality community kind of misses either 50% or way more than 50% of the patrons that Golden Century would have meant something to.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a case to be made. That possibly kind of, yeah, missing some aspects of it. I think, like, it was definitely a restaurant, like, in hospitality, you heard about it because you heard of all these, you know, industry legends going there late night. So that was kind of what made its name. And in hospitality, people love having that local bar or that local spot where you sort of, you know, other people at the tables, like, you know, after work, you meet up with other people. And that's just probably got the highest, you know, profile chefs and industry people going to it. So if you were a part of that club, there's a little bit of like, I want to show people that I was part of that little exclusive Golden Century club. So, as much as everything on social media
kind
is,
of what I see a bit.
Yeah, it's performative in that sense where, like, you know, you're sad. Like, I'm not saying people are disingenuous, but I think there's a little bit of I was part of that legendary time. Just so you all know. I think there's a little bit of that.
I think you've articulated that very well.
Yeah. Like I would be similar, like, if one of my local favorite bars closed,
if Howling Wolf closed.
Yeah, I'd feel like I was more upset than other people. Like, I'd be like, you're not really upset. Like, I was a real local there. Like I would be the same as well. So you just have this, and especially hospitality people, we have a weird little ownership of other people's businesses in a way. you feel like, like, oh, you know, but I was always there. So I think it's social media performative, but it has seemed like a massive outpouring and sadness over a iconic venue closing.
It's an interesting one. We'll probably leave it there for that because let's move on. But you know, whenever we post about this, people can bloody put in the comments what they think. I don't know. Maybe we're being too cynical. All right, let's move on to our next section of this Stock Takes episode. And this is where we talk about something that's just tickling us a little bit on Instagram, whether it's in a good way or a bad way or an interesting way or whatever that may be. And I'm going to go first, Simon.
Okay. You're the most important one.
I it's very, like, easy to just notice trends on Instagram because they spread like wildfire, like certain trends on Instagram. So what I've been doing is that every time someone shares a picture of a Basque cheesecake on Instagram, I've been screenshotting it and saving it to my phone. And so, like, this is, you know, it could be either a media organization putting out a recipe, like, you know, Gourmet Traveler did one recently. Or, I mean, it's a no-brainer if people want to do takeaway and things like that. I'm not going to call out any Australian venues because there's people that I know quite well that are doing Basque cheesecakes. But, like, Vespertine in LA is doing Basque cheesecakes. You know, all over the world, people are just frothing the Basque cheesecake, Simon. I'll say Attica's doing Basque cheesecakes. We can talk about that because Attica's Attica and they're fine. But, yeah, essentially everyone's doing Basque cheesecakes, and I just found that interesting.
It just seems the popular dish right now. Yeah. And, like, some of them don't look that good. Some of them look like a burnt. I just want to know, like, I've had one. Yeah. I find you need, I find you can't eat them on their own. I found that, like, you need some acid or some like sweetness, like from something else.
Yeah. Like a scoop of ice cream. Or
yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Now I never made one.
I've made one.
I've only, well, I mean, like I made one, but I didn't mean to make one. Now, is that how they started?
How did you make one without meaning to make one? Did you have a base on
it? No, I left it in the oven too long.
Yeah, but did you, like, the whole thing about a Basque cheesecake is that the burnt exterior is the crust and you don't actually have...
So there's no base, is that what you're saying?
No, there's no base.
So you just put some bacon paper down and chuck your thing in.
And they're really fucking easy. And, like, to cook at home... It's actually a really great dessert to cook at home because it's super easy. I recommend people use the Bon Appetit recipe. The Bon Appetit magazine recipe is like a really simple, good one for a really successful Basque cheesecake. And I think it's a great dish. It's just, I don't know. A lot of them.
there's just a lot of them.
There's a lot of them around.
Yeah, I think it's the issue when you see trends like this happen. How many are good? How many are bad? What are they supposed to be like? Especially when it's a Basque country peasant dish, and we're sort of in Australia. Like, are we anywhere near what they're supposed to be like? Lots of questions, but there's definitely a burnt Basque cheesecake epidemic, I might say.
So what right you, now. Let's move on. What are you looking at on Instagram?
Just the rise of a website called Provador,
double so
like your door.
Genius. Works perfectly.
Play on words. So with everyone doing takeaway cook at home meal kits, obviously these guys have seen a good little gap in the market to provide the delivery and the logistics as a third party website. So lots of Sydney and Melbourne so far restaurants. Seems like there's more and more.
The lineup of restaurants on Provador is
exceptional.
So let's just go through them. Icebergs, Otto, Sake, Neil Perry, Alberto's Lounge, Spice Temple, Chichiabella, Chiswick, Rockpool, Bentley, Fratelli Paradiso, Hubert, Chop House, Nort, The Apollo, Chocho Sun, Cirrus Golden Century, Lankin Filling Station, Lotus, DOC, Monopole, XOPP, Hojack, Bistro, Three Blue Ducks, Yellow, Chap Thai, Bentley, The Baxter Inn, Shady Pines. Like, come on. That is out of control.
Yeah.
That's just...
So- Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And obviously Melbourne, and they seem pretty new since a lot of people get on board. I got some food delivered from them recently.
Really?
I did, yes. Kept this from you. So I got a couple of steaks from Rockpool and got some of the stuff from Yellow. And I think we ordered the night before, the afternoon before a cut-off time. And it arrived all packaged in a chilled box at like 11 a.m. the next day. And we cooked up at 9. So
what did you get? Take me through the menu. Like, what's the Rockpool Provador menu look like?
I mean, I was looking through at everyone, seeing what I wanted. And I thought Rockpool was good value for money. It was like $180 for two, but
that's how Simon makes his decisions, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, he's always looking for a bargain. The bar,
yeah, you know, it's downturn in trade at the moment. Love a bargain. Yeah, if I've got the money. So we got there was a cheese. There was some very nice ham, which I actually just had on a sandwich the next day. There was some ham, cheese, and pickles. There was a little cheese course. There was some prawns and two steaks, two sides, and a little chocolate cake dessert. So,
and how was it? How was the process of like opening it up and cooking it and those sorts of things?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I had to jazz it up a little bit, make it, you know, put my spin on it.
Your own spin on it.
Yeah, obviously. Why not? Because you had to. Use some nice plates and bowls. it comes with instructions. The steaks were seared off. Basically to cuisson, then you just reheat them. The sides went in the oven, so it was all very simple. idiot-proof, some might say, with I imagine some of the people trying to cook it at home. But I think it's a great option for better restaurants right now because, you know, most of those restaurants couldn't be doing Uber Eats. The food doesn't work enough. It doesn't travel hot like that. It's very hard. And then obviously you can try and get like Babyface do pickups. You go pick it up and it's hot and you go straight home. That works, but it's in a place like Sydney where there's, you know, such a larger scope of place. Also they deliver to Wollongong. They deliver one of my employees has got it coming this weekend, I think.
Where do they deliver to? Can they deliver to me?
I'm not sure how far they go, but they do go down to like Kangaroo Valley. I know they go that far. I'm not sure how much further.
Not far enough.
Well, yeah, you're pretty far away. But
delivery information. I'm looking at it now.
Look at it now. Delivery was like $16. All came chilled, very, very swift, very tasty. And I just think, yeah, it's a great idea for restaurants that can't really do Uber Eats, can't do Deliveroo. They can still provide good food. The cooking was minimal. Like, so we did it as you go. Took a couple of minutes for each sort of course. And everything looked good. And like, yeah, and the restaurants on there are awesome. Like, it's, I imagine it's something that restaurants might keep going forward after lockdown. Restaurants from Sydney can deliver.
Yeah, it looks awesome. The lineup and the way that it's presented and whoever did this, like the photography even of the food and how it's all explained nicely. And it's got that sort of, it's almost got a sort of a Silicon Valley, really good sort of tech functionality to it.
It's well done. So it'd be great to see them, possibly expand to maybe be able to do some restaurants outside Sydney and maybe bring some regional restaurants to the city. That'd be a great step.
That's cool. Yeah, that's a great idea.
I'm not sure they're doing that. This is my suggestion to them. So Provador, if you need tips, let us know and we'll help out any way we can.
I like that.
Good look. I definitely think regional, try and shop regional first, go to your local restaurants, but definitely worth a little treat to get some Sydney food in,
That's a cool one. Yep, nice. All right, let's wrap it up, Simon. We've got a couple of tips happening each. Let's go. You go first. I just went first in that segment. So final tips, one hot tip each to finish off the stock takes.
Yeah, use your freezer. Learn what things freeze well. Vegetables, fruit, don't freeze well. They go to shit.
Except for peel bananas and freeze them.
Always with the fucking bananas. yes, that's one. Also, I mean, if you do freeze strawberries, they're really good to make jam. But generally, if you want to have fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, they're shit. Fish, not so bad. Meat freezes all right. Don't listen to what most chefs say. Like, if you have to freeze it, freeze it. But liquids, they freeze great. So stocks, sauces. Like, even if you get, like, you get some like broth delivered from your local Chinese, it's normally too much broth. Just like fill up a little cute little ice tray, bung it in your freezer, and then you've got something to chuck in whatever when you need it.
Mm. I think what would be, I've got a lot of tips for freezing, but I think that people get worried about buying high quality sourdough because they think they're not able to eat the whole thing a day if they live by themselves or if they live with just one other person. They're like, oh, if we buy a fucking $12 loaf of ancient grain sourdough or some shit right now, we're not going to be able to finish it. Slice it up and just put it in the freezer and put it in the toaster because it is fantastic.
For toast, it's great.
And you know, you'll never regret that. So that's like the easiest possible way to get around the conundrum of, I'm one person, I like good bread, I don't want to buy a whole loaf because it'll go stale and whatever. It's fine. Eat a few slices fresh and then just freeze the rest and it's still worth your $10 or however
Bread's a game changer when you freeze it. Yeah. Even if you just get like a sliced loaf, like how many people throw away that last part of your sliced loaf? I'm gonna go on a limb and say absolutely everyone, every single time. Has anyone ever finished a loaf of bread? I'm not sure. But like you could just freeze that end down, pull it out for toast.
Yeah.
Love a bit
of
toast.
It's one of the best things for food waste as well, the old freezer. And I think I don't know, like, a lot, you know, people have their own different levels of what's acceptable to them for...
Quick contentious opinion. Shit bread makes better toast.
Shit bread makes better toast. What do you mean?
Yeah. So I went to like local, like a tiny little like supermarket in a little, like not far from my little villagey thing near Wollongong. And I just bought it was like the only bread they had. I wanted the toasty. So I bought this bread. And when I looked at like the ingredient list, it had like milk, soy, like it was shit bread. It was like impossibly soft and fluffy. Like that can't have been baked. That had to be like manufactured. And I've just been having toast of it, and it's the best toast.
All right. Okay.
And I just don't like sourdough toast that much.
I do. I love sourdough toast.
Really?
Yeah.
Fucking Aussies. You bloody just obsession.
Vegemite on sourdough and with really good butter is
sourdough is not always the best bread. There's
Oh, it's true. I agree. Definitely agree.
Right. It's another podcast.
The other thing that I'll touch on is if you want to make stocks, like if you're a person that isn't at making stock level in your cooking at home, or you think that it's a bit of a pain in the ass, or you don't have the time for it, and it sometimes can be hard, right? Like if you want to, like say if you buy a chicken and you bone it out and you've got these pile of bones and then you've got all the chicken and you actually want to cook dinner with the chicken, but you've still got all these bones. It's just have like, just freeze bones. Like, like for me, like I do a bit of fishing and spear fishing and all that sort of thing. And if you like, say if one night I want to make fish and chips and I've just caught some fish, I'm, you know, a food waste zealot. So I'm like, let's not waste this, but I'll come home and I'll fillet the fish. I'll make fish and chips for dinner. And then I'll just freeze the frames. And then every time I've got like a piece of fish or, you know, sorry, a whole fish, or even if it's, you know, prawns that I've shelled or a lobster or whatever, I just freeze all that until I've got like a Sunday afternoon and I'm like, all right, like now let's make a really nice big fish stock. And it's super easy. So it makes it like, if you want to be, you know, using some of those things that you usually discard, even pieces of vegetables, even things like vegetable peels or tops and tails of onions and carrots and things like that, you can freeze all that. And when you've got the time, you can make a stock out of it. And it's a really good way to sort of avoid food waste. So
yeah,
heaps of different tips. Use your freezer. That sort of brings me. Sorry, Simon, you go for it.
Yeah, no. I was going to say, Stefan, what is your tip?
Yeah, segue. So,
show us your tip.
My tip is, and it's based on. I'm going to brag for a second, but I went for a dive this morning.
Did you go to Golden Century?
No, I didn't go to Golden Century, but I did get the lobster. I went for a dive this morning, and I got a really nice lobster and four abalone, and I'm like. I don't know. It's just made my day. Like it's literally made my day. And I'm so looking forward to cooking it for dinner tonight. It's ridiculous. And, you know, you're a man who loves foraging for your own ingredients and things. And we've talked to people like Mark LeBroy on this podcast and John Raleigh, who are avid hunters.
Mad hunters.
And I guess the tip is if you can, if you're in this sort of world, whether it's foraging or fishing or collecting wild oysters or hunting or whatever it might be. Like even another one is like, you can go to blueberry farms and pick your own blueberries and weigh them and pay for them. Or you can go to, maybe not now, there's orchards that you can go to where you can pick fruit yourself and go and pay for them. But there is something about harvesting your own food, whether it's foraging or fishing or hunting or gathering mushrooms, all of this sort of stuff that is, it just brings you so much closer to your food. And you always cook these things with such a reverence. Like you cook them in a different way. You treat them so much different to if you had to just go into the shops and bought them. So my tip is to, if you can, if you've got the means, if you've got the time, figure out
let's go seafood wise for you. What would be the absolute easiest thing for someone to be able to collect themselves?
If you know how to snorkel, you can gather sea urchins. Wherever you go on the east coast of Australia, there will be Centrostephanus sea urchins, which are the big purple ones, and they will have sea urchin roe inside them, which is edible. And I've talked about instructions before. We've talked about instructions before, and I might put a instructional on my website, quicksandfood.com, on how to clean urchins. But if you know how to snorkel, you can gather urchins. You just have to get a bag, a Hessian sack, whatever you want to put in them, and a pair of gloves. All you need is a pair of gloves, and you are able to gather sea urchins. And you can get 10 of them, which is like way more than you need. Like no one needs 10 sea urchins.
Yeah.
And begin there.
Yeah. We did a bump of urchin and caviar after a shoot, and that was enough. That was one tongue.
Exactly.
So that's all you need.
That is the new website. The easiest. What about foraging? Warrigal
greens. Yeah, warrigal greens. First of all, like, there's nothing else that looks like warrigal greens, so there's no worry about picking, you know, some other plant. You'll find them normally, like, I mean, they'll pop up almost anywhere, but near sort of creeks, on the dunes, in the little part between the land and the dunes, like normally with a little bit of cover, you'll find them around there. Like, Google them, look at them, keep your eye out for them, and you'll find them. And then you can just use them like spinach. Yeah. Like I said, they're so easy. They're always in really good condition. They're really bright, amazing green color, really good for you. There is always a lurking rumor that you have to cook them, which is actually untrue. They're actually no higher in oxalic acid than most other things. But, yeah, stew them down. Use them like spinach. Put a couple of small ones in your salad. Delicious. I mean, if you've been fishing, you'll probably find them around the beaches fishing somewhere. Grab them. Go great with fish.
Yep. Awesome. All right, Simon, that's great. Let's leave it there. I think it's a successful first Stock Takes episode.
Take that stock.
We obviously a lot longer than half an hour, but
discuss stock every episode?
No, but we did get a lot of stock in this one.
Yeah.
Stock Takes. All right. Thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Cheers.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.